It is Thursday, June 23rd, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, we'll get an update on the British referendum on whether or not the country should remain in the European Union from our London correspondent. A VOA Latin American service journalist explains the significance of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that scuttled a plan by President Obama to shield undocumented migrants from deportation. We'll find out why House Democrats ended a sit-in here in Washington that brought attention to the lack of legislation on gun violence, and we'll hear why Colombia's government and a rebel group are deciding to end a long-running conflict. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, polls have just closed in the UK on the referendum on whether or not the United Kingdom should remain in the European Union. Our correspondent in London, Luis Ramirez, was at some polling stations today in the British capital. I spoke to him on the phone a short time ago, and I asked him what he saw.
Well, certainly there was a great deal of enthusiasm. This has been such a passionate, sometimes ugly debate that people really seem very eager to go out and vote on this. This is something that people feel very strongly about. And so they turned out in pretty strong numbers despite the bad weather. We had in London the torrential rainstorms throughout the day and flooding. Yet there was a steady stream at the polling stations that I went to. I was at one in North London during opening time. That was 7 a.m. London time. People on their way to work casting their ballots. A great deal of concern about the unknown, what will happen if Britain does decide to leave the EU. That was what was on the minds of many voters, and they obviously were people who chose to remain. On the part of those who want out of the European Union, concerns about overreach by the EU governing apparatus in Brussels, and the big concern driving people was the issue of immigration. And so a very passionate debate that drew a pretty large turnout despite the weather.
Well, how are people reacting to final opinion polls that showed a late swing toward the Remain vote just before the voting started today?
Many of the people I spoke to at the polling station said they have made their minds up for quite a while, despite what they said was really a great deal of confusion, lots of facts and figures being thrown out by both sides. Many people didn't know quite what to believe. They'd made up, though, their mind long ago. There was a group of voters who were undecided until just a few hours before the referendum began. And while those people gave it some final thought, looked at the final arguments, and decided that they should vote because this is a historic election. It's the first time in more than four decades where the British people have a chance to directly say what they want to do about the European Union. And so this was something that that people really felt they needed to get out and do.
Okay, well, thank you very much to our London correspondent, Luis Ramirez, for bringing us the latest on the EU referendum in Britain.
All right, Michael, thanks so much.
Okay, well, we are turning our attention now to what is buzzing online with the EU referendum. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is with me in the studio to do just that. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael. Like Louis said, the poll closed at 10 p.m. Thursday local time, and many British politicians actively voiced their opinions on Twitter. And Prime Minister David Cameron was one of them. His handle is @David_Cameron, and his two favorite hashtags to use have been #VoteRemain and #StrongerIn. Of course, the second hashtag means his country is stronger as part of the EU. Now, one of his many tweets sent out on Thursday reads like this. Remember to #VoteRemain by 10 p.m. tonight to keep Britain stronger, safer, and better off in Europe. #StrongerIn. And although he's the political leader of the country, there is someone far more popular on Twitter, and that's Nigel Farage, who is the leader of the Independence Party.
So what did he tweet today?
Well, he's on Twitter @Nigel_Farage and tweeted this a couple hours ago. If you want your borders back, if you want your democracy back, if you want your country back, then vote to leave. #IndependenceDay. Nearly 2,000 people liked it so far, compared to just a couple hundred likes for Mr. Cameron's tweets. Farage is also prolific on Facebook, and he posted, "Today is your opportunity to help take back control of our borders. Please get out there, vote, and urge your friends, family, and colleagues to do the same. Every vote matters in this referendum." And not surprisingly, most of the comments to that post echoed his decision. Many people wrote that those who have the backbone will vote to leave the EU, and criticized the national broadcaster BBC for what they perceive as biased reporting.
Well, what would you say is the overriding sentiment on social media regarding this referendum?
It's different depending on the medium, but on Twitter, many people using the hashtag EUREF expressed the desire to leave the EU. Michael?
Thanks so much, G, for that wrap-up. You can tweet your questions and comments to us at hashtag VOA underscore, at VOA underscore IE, and you can tag G and I on those tweets. Our handles are at Michael underscore Lippin and at G Abby Lee. Here are some of the top stories trending now in Asia. UNHCR tells Pakistan not all Afghan refugees are terrorists. In China, a powerful tornado strikes the country's east, killing 78 people. Thousands of people attend the funeral of a slain Pakistani Sufi singer. And researchers say gun control stopped mass shootings in Australia. Expanded coverage of those stories and more is on voanews.com and on their VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And International Edition continues. Well, a deadlocked U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday thwarted President Barack Obama's plan to defer the deportation of millions of undocumented migrants. Those plans were going to protect the undocumented parents of American citizens and also undocumented children who came to the United States. So earlier I spoke to our VOA Latin American service anchor, Gonzalo Abarca, and I asked him to explain the significance of this Supreme Court ruling on immigration in the United States.
Yeah, Michael, devastating really for the Latin community. The basically what happened today is it does affect 5 million people, 5 million people that right now are leaving with a lot of anxiety. They can't even get driver license. They can obviously, they can vote. So basically what happened is that the Supreme Court decided that, well, really, it was a tie, you know, 4-4. So what happened is that these people now, because the Supreme Court got that tied, it was really not a ruling. So the lower court decision withhold. What happened to these parents? These parents are subject to deportation, immediate deportation. However, the President Barack Obama, speaking to them, said that, don't worry. Basically, the message across was, don't worry. We have more other things, you know, other immigrants.
Well, he was saying we have other undocumented people
we want to deport first. After them, right. What is the problem here? The problem is that right now, any of those parents that for any reason, let's say that they have a traffic, an accident, they might get deported because it will be a traffic violation. They will be violating the law.
So if they commit any offense, that just puts them higher up the list for deportation.
Right. As an immigrant myself, one of the things that we're very cautious about it is that do not get into any trouble because that might be in your record. So what the immigration authorities are going to look at after is your background. If you have any of these things, you can be deported immediately.
Well, what are the pro-immigration groups going to do next now that they have this legal setback?
Well, Michael, the only thing that is left, remember that President Obama is pretty much is a lame duck, is the end of his term, is going to be up to the new president. And the new president really have to deal with Congress. Very difficult, have to deal with Congress in order to approve what is called a new immigration law, which is really, it will embrace exactly what's happening in the United States. Not only deportation and trying to punish some people, but rather dealing with the broken system we have right now.
And it looks like there could be two very different outcomes depending on whether it's going to be President Trump or Clinton. But
absolutely. You said it right. Two different paths. Two different paths, Michael.
Okay, well, thank you very much to Latin American division anchor Gonzalo Abarca for speaking to International Edition.
It's always a pleasure to be here with you, Michael.
Well, moving on, House Democrats have ended a 24, almost 26-hour sit-in on the House chamber floor. This was a protest by the Democrats to raise awareness about what they say is the lack of gun legislation on the part of their Republican colleagues in light of the recent Orlando massacre. I spoke to our House correspondent, Catherine Gibson, on the phone. She was following the events in the House, and I asked her what the Democrats feel they've achieved by holding this more than day-long protest.
They felt that they had reached a point, they had reached the 24-hour mark and gone a little bit past it, and they felt that they had made the world aware of their goals and their hopes for legislation. They said that when they come back after the July 4th holiday break, they'll continue this fight, and the break will be an opportunity to talk to their constituents, strategize about next steps forward, and see where they take this fight next.
Well, you know, House Speaker Paul Ryan, he continued his criticism of the sit-in today, saying it was a fundraising tool for the Democrats. Do we know that the Democrats actually were able to raise any money based off of the publicity they got for this protest?
You know, it's unclear if they were able to raise any money. They certainly had a large group of supporters here around Capitol Hill last night through the morning and into today when they ended the sit-in. A lot of people supporting their calls for gun violence legislation. And, you know, I'm certain that the images that were beamed around the world on Periscope and on Facebook Live will do their part in encouraging people to donate to the cause.
What do the Democrats think they can do next to actually achieve progress toward their goal? Are we going to see basically a repeat sit-in after the 4th of July?
They were very careful about answering that question today when they ended their sit-in outside the Capitol. They spoke in very broad terms about next steps, about strategizing, and mostly about building a dialogue with their Republican colleagues. You know, I saw a couple of members of Congress shout out to their Republican colleagues on the House floor late last night trying to start that dialogue. And, of course, they were shouted down, and then there was the back and forth. So we can see if maybe in a little less heated atmosphere, a little bit of that dialogue can begin.
Well, I was just going to ask you, given that there were some House Republicans who were quite angered at how the Democrats were breaking the House rules with this sit-in, do you think that the protest makes the possibility of a compromise between Democrats and Republicans more likely or less likely?
Well, you know, in this partisan atmosphere up on Capitol Hill, I don't know if anything can make things worse, but there was certainly signs of anger, of frustration last night. They were trying to get a vote going. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan looked visibly frustrated as he tried to gavel everybody into order. He spoke this morning about the need for that order, about the possibility of a process and how the Democrats need to respect that process. He actually said that this was not a good day for democracy. So I think House Republicans will talk a lot about that in the coming days and use that as something against their Democratic colleagues.
Well, thanks a lot. That was a great wrap-up of the developments in the House. Thank you to our correspondent, Catherine Gibson.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. The Colombian government and the leftist FARC rebel force signed a ceasefire agreement on Thursday, bringing the country closer to ending a half-century of conflict. President Juan Manuel Santos and FARC leader Timoleon Jimenez signed the deal at a ceremony in Havana, Cuba, in the presence of international leaders, including UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Lina Correa is a show host for VOA's Latin American service and is from Colombia. I spoke to her today and asked her what she sees as the significance of this agreement.
Yes, it is not a final piece, but is the most significant piece of this long process. Remember, 52 years have passed of the internal conflict in Colombia. Actually, this is the oldest guerrilla group in the world. So to get these guys to make the commitment to leave their 52 years past, their revolutionary ideas, it's huge. But also the place where it is taking place.
In Cuba.
In Cuba is very significant too, because it shows that the peace process and the agreement reached today goes beyond Colombian borders. And it means another big change this year for the whole hemisphere.
Well, why is this agreement being signed now? How do you explain the timing of it?
It has been a long time that not only President Santos, it had been many attempts. Maybe the most notorious was around 1998, 2000, when the Andrés Pastrana was the Colombian president, and a peace process took place at that time, but it was a disaster at the end because the FARC basically laughed at Colombian people. And that is why this peace process has a lot of skepticism still skepticism among many people in Colombia. I think that this agreement will make a change in some of the Colombian minds, some of those who are still opposed to the peace process, but it's still a long way to go to the real reconciliation in Colombia. That is why the peace process is not over, but this agreement is very significant. It's like what is the word in English when you reach a point where there is no coming back?
A point of no return.
Yes, it's a point of no return.
Well, interesting that you're talking about the skepticism, because there were previous attempts that failed, and there's still more obstacles that both sides have to overcome. Can you tell us what are those obstacles that they still face?
Basically, there are two obstacles. One is the participation in politics. Some members of the FARC have committed crimes against humanity, violation of the human rights and the international human rights law. So for them, it will be impossible to get a place or to participate in an electoral process. But there are some others that could be there, could reach those positions. So let's see how it plays. Because the other thing is that this agreement has to be validated by Colombian people.
In a referendum.
It's not a referendum, it's something similar to a referendum. The conditions are a little different, but at the end of the day, it's the same thing. It's a plebiscito, is the word in Spanish. And the second point is the victims. How do you avoid the repetition, and how will you grant that the victims will be compensated with truth, with justice and reparation?
And those are going to be tough challenges, I'm sure, for any government to implement. But thank you very much, Lina Correa, also with the Latin American Division of VOA, an anchor there. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
It is a pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity.
Well, it's time for a look at the entertainment world and a more serious topic, how to protect performing artists around the world from deadly violence. For more on that, VOA Music's Ray McDonald sat down with International Edition's Steve Miller.
Gun violence is, of course, front and center in the news here in the United States, especially in the wake of not only the Orlando shootings, but the killing of singer Christina Grimmie. Billboard magazine has spoken to seven security experts about this issue. Ray McDonald's here with me in the studio. What is being said?
Hi, Steve. Billboard is making this a high priority item. The July 2nd edition features an open letter on the cover calling for meaningful action on gun control, and it was signed by more than 180 music industry execs and artists. And I think artists in the music industry are feeling this issue very acutely because they routinely put themselves in front of hundreds or even thousands of people. People that they've never seen before.
Well, that's the whole draw of stardom, right? I mean, not only to produce your content and get it out there, but also to meet the people that resonate with it.
Absolutely. And that can be a positive, but it can also be a negative. And this is really a long-running problem. Way back in 2004, a fan shot and killed a rock guitarist named Dimebag Darrell Abbott, along with three others, in an Ohio nightclub. But then, of course, more recently, you've had the shootings at the Bataclan Theater in Paris. You had the shooting of Christina Grimmie by a deranged fan in Orlando. You had a shooting at a TI show at Irving Plaza in New York City. But it's
not even at these clubs, right? I mean, look back to John Lennon as well on the streets.
Absolutely, and that dates back to 1980. So, what to do? Well, Billboard asked seven security experts to weigh in on how to protect performers and fans at live venues. And this is what they said. First and foremost, security costs are going to increase, and fans will likely pay for this. Investments will include metal detectors and increased training for security personnel. More specifically, the security experts recommended that you have a plan in place addressing vulnerabilities and threats. It can come from inside or outside the venue. Number three, the venues need to communicate with each other about training and artist security needs to work with venue security. Metal detectors. Metal detectors are a big piece of the puzzle here. Cost has been a deterrent in the past because the big full-body metal detectors can run you up to $5,000. It has been a deterrent for many venues, especially the smaller clubs. But the mindset is changing here with the increased sense of urgency that the people are feeling.
And that was VOA's Ray McDonald speaking to Steve Miller. That's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Early on January 1st, 2008, as they were leaving a New Year's Eve celebration, an American diplomat and a Sudanese citizen, both employed by the U.S. Agency for International Development, were shot and killed in an ambush in Khartoum, Sudan. John Granville, 33 years old, had been working on democracy and governance programs for USAID in support of a landmark peace agreement that ended Sudan's long civil war. Abdulrahman Abbas Rahama, 39, had joined USAID as a member of its disaster assistance response team for Darfur. Five men were arrested and convicted in connection with the killings, but four escaped, and two remain at large, most recently somewhere in Somalia. Identified as the leader of the attack, Mohammed Makawi Ibrahim Mohammed is a Sudanese national, 29 years old, with black hair and dark brown eyes. He has ties to a group in Sudan called Al-Qaeda in the Lands of the Two Niles that had plotted to attack U.S., Western, and Sudanese interests. Abdul Basit Al-Haj Al-Hassan Haj Hamad was identified as the second shooter in the attack. He also is a Sudanese national, believed to be between 30 and 34 years old, with black hair and dark brown eyes. For their role in the attacks, they have been designated as terrorists, and information on their whereabouts is being sought by the United States government. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million each for information leading to the capture of these men. The United States guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on either of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy. Submit a tip on the Rewards for Justice website, www.rewardsforjustice.net, or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.